stocks start a new month and a holiday shortened week with the S&P 500 within earshot of all-time high levels. But the big story Tuesday, at least to start the week, crude hitting the highest levels since October 2018, and the dollar index touching its lowest levels in nearly a year. I'm Aaron Task, along with Stephen Alfer. We are joined today by Bob Iacino, co-portfolio manager of the Stock Think Tank and host of the Market Think Tank. Bob, welcome back to Alpha Trader.
Yeah, good to be here, guys. Thanks for having me again.
Great to have you. I will note for the audience, we're talking here late morning on Tuesday. The S&P struggling to hold on to its earlier gains. The Nasdaq's dipped into negative territory. Fairly quiet. Stocks in a tight range, but oil jumping was up over 3% earlier this morning. The OPEC Plus meeting is happening in Vienna virtually. They're sticking to its plan to hike oil output in July. We also have the OECD raising its forecast for global economic growth. And oh, by the way, President Biden releasing his first budget over the weekend, and it was a doozy, a whopper, just a huge amount of spending, $6 trillion for fiscal year 2022. So when you put that all together, along with some of the economic data we've been seeing, what is the crude market telling you right now, Bob Iacino?
Well, a couple of things. And again, I want to thank you guys for having me again. This is always fun to do, but you took my doozy and whopper, so I don't have much to say about the budget. So let's get that out there. In terms of crude oil specifically, I've been long crude oil. I've talked about it on multiple TV appearances, as well as to our own clients, that I was long crude oil, but I didn't really love it. And part of the reason that I didn't really love it is crude oil has characteristics. It's a pure supply and demand market. It's one of the reasons it's the thing that I personally trade the most. We don't do it for clients, but I do it for myself. And individually, crude oil, it used to be the most volatile thing to trade prior to the advent of cryptocurrencies. And now it's the second most volatile thing to trade. And the trade that I had had so much room before it actually broke out of ranges and either took me to my profit targets or took me out of the trade, that it ends up taking up a large portion of risk capital, which is why, side note here, I'm so excited about the CME launching their micro crude, but that's a whole nother conversation. From crude oil, goes sideways until it doesn't. And what that really means is it exists in a balance between supply and demand, and it gets priced in at those levels and within a fairly, usually a fairly tight range. This particular range was basically from about 63 to about where we are now. It's about 67. So I was able to get long down in that 64 area. I'm not comfortable giving out exact levels, but I was long around that 64 area to get to a target of about 69. And you're ending up with about a $2,000 or $3,000 stop per contract, which starts to get a little uncomfortable when you have these wide ranges. For me, the demand side of crude is really the story. As we continue to reopen, and whether we reopen or not, revenge travel seems to be real. Restaurant eating seems to be real. Driving trips, that sort of revenge seems to be real. And the demand seems to be climbing a lot quicker than OPEC seems to be willing to put out oil to balance it. And you would expect that from OPEC, because you and I and they know that shale oil is not coming back as quickly as it may have in the past. So right. OPEC as an institution or as a consortium now are the marginal producer, and they know it. So they're likely to drive the market higher by sort of dripping out extra supply into this demand.
I prefer cartel for OPEC, but
cartel's fine.
We'll go with consortium as well. But you referenced something about shale not coming back, and I want to read you something that I read on Seeking Alpha today in the Wall Street Breakfast Rundown. Western oil majors are under pressure to cut carbon emissions faster, especially after the courtroom and boardroom defeats seen last week at Exxon, Chevron, and Shell. New energy policies proposed by the Biden administration are also discouraging the production of fossil fuels, meaning more business for OPEC Plus and the likes of Saudi Aramco, ADNOC, and Rosneft. Quote, it looks like the West will have to rely more on what it calls hostile regimes for its supply, joked a high-level executive from Russia's Gazprom. End quote. So this to me suggests that OPEC Plus, maybe they're starting to feel they can have more control over the market than they did just a few years ago. Is that an accurate read? And do you agree with the essential gist of that section I just read you?
Sure. I think it's accurate and somewhat obvious. Whether people want to say it out loud or not, regardless of what happens going forward with rig counts, we're nowhere near the 2014 highs of about 888 rigs, not anywhere close to the 2008 highs, which I believe is above 1600 rigs. So you're talking about overseas oil is what we're going to become dependent on coming out of the pandemic, as well as the amount of carbon fuels that are needed to convert to green, which I pretty much everyone I talk to is for. I'm for on some level, but it takes carbon fuels to do that. You know, how much is in dispute, but that's not what I do for a living. So we're now reliant, because of the lack of shale drilling and the lack of capital expenditures in that region. Last I looked, we were at about 360 rigs or so. That's double the pandemic lows, but as I mentioned, still 200% lower than the 2008 levels. So we've got a long way to go before the U.S. has any sort of managing power over the price of crude oil and the price of gas at the pumps. It's not going to discourage people from traveling in the pandemic boom, but it just may actually curtail the travel in the pandemic boom a lot quicker than maybe the airlines would like.
Right. So what I'm hearing you say is I should expect to pay higher prices at the pump, this summer, as I'm driving my family wherever we may go. Airline travel may not continue this ascent that it's on, no pun intended. But I just want to be clear, are you still long crude here?
Yes.
Or is this okay? Because I was going to say it kind of has a feel a little bit this morning like this is maybe some kind of near term peak with all the news baked in. And as you said, it seems obvious now why crude is rising.
Well, again, so I said it wasn't really comfortable. Let me just give exact levels so it'll make it more clear. I bought at 63.54 in the July crude oil. Okay. And my stop was around 61.30. So we didn't get to that 61.30 level. My target's 69.75. Now, my target is 69.75 because my target is $70.11, and people get a little crazy around round numbers. So I always like to get out a little bit before those round numbers. And yes, it's toppy from the jump. But again, OPEC has tended to surprise and predict in the direction of higher prices. When they put out demand estimates, they're usually higher than the IEA and the EIA. When they put out supply estimates, they're usually lower than the IEA and EIA. They tend to sort of lean to surprise to the upside for prices. So the way that we operate is we have our active investments planned out. And because we operate that way as a firm, I operate that way personally, obviously. And my target's in that high $69 range, and I'm not going to get out of it until then. So whenever somebody asks me if I'm still long, if they know my target, I just kind of roll my eyes and look at them. And they, of course I am. I'm long until my target. You guys didn't know my target, so now we do.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I'm going to say that. What this particular move today is it's a breakout of a slightly upward slanting channel. And the top of that channel is around 66.42, 66.50, that area. So I would honestly expect to pull back to that level before I got my target. It's another opportunity for some people. I'm not recommending the trade because that's not what we do here, but it is an opportunity for some people to gauge for themselves if that channel is going to be broken back down into, or whether it's testing the level and it's going to rock it back up. And that's my prediction. That's why I'm long. So I don't expect it to go up in a straight line, but I do expect crude to do what it always does, which is have a channel and either break out and trend or break out and establish a new channel. Whether that's higher or lower, my prediction is higher. And I think the new channel is going to be about 66.50 to about 70.50.
Got it. And I seem to recall from our prior conversations that you don't trade energy stocks because you prefer to trade crude itself. Do you have a thought, though? Do you see continued upside for energy stocks, which have had a great move since roughly September of last year?
Well, so that's a great question, I think, because what's happening with energy stocks now is either they're digging in or they're professing that they're going to convert to green energy. If they convert to green energy, I like them as companies, but I don't like their stock because it's going to cost money and it's not what they do. If they dig in, I probably like the stock, but I don't like it long term because we're obviously going to go to renewables at some, whether it's a slow move or a fast move, that's where we're going. That's where we should be going. So again, there's a reason for me that if I like the price action in crude oil, to trade the actual thing that is 100% correlated to crude oil, which is crude oil. So that's the way I always look at it. I remember looking at data back in 2018, 2017, and looking at the divergence between Exxon specifically, but Chevron as well, and how much crude had been up on a percentage basis, which was somewhere in the range of 97%. And Exxon had actually been down 9%. Chevron had only been up 60%. And I thought to myself, why would I trade these if my opinion was in crude oil? Now, that doesn't mean that we won't recommend an energy stock to our subscribers and also put it into our model portfolio. But it would be for different reasons. It wouldn't be because we thought crude oil specifically was going up.
You kind of touched on this, but I'm kind of amazed that we're in a situation where the producers of crude oil no longer want to be in the crude oil production business. And, you know, BP and Exxon now, you don't love the stocks to invest in when you like crude oil, but are there any producers, majors or otherwise, who won't toe? The ball is clearly in the ESG court right now. They control the conversation, right? But we're still a long way between using oil and using banana peels to drive our cars. Are there any producers, are there any executives who are contrarians here saying, no, crude oil is the future. We're continue to look for opportunity to drill and explore.
I don't remember his name, to be honest, but I saw an interview with a CEO, and because I don't remember his name, I don't want to mess up and say the wrong company either. But I remember seeing the interview where he basically said, this is all crazy. We're going to be on fossil fuels for 50 years. I guess for me, it's difficult to discern. And this is why we rely so much on price action in the stock think tank to end up choosing the investments that we actually make, is because I don't know which boards and CEOs are just filled with flowery rhetoric and which ones are actually making the conversion. So that's another reason why I don't necessarily look at them when I'm looking at an energy thesis. I'll look at crude oil. I'll look at natural gas. I'll say, what does the price action look like? Do I think we're going into a cycle? For example, natural gas is going into a pretty strong down seasonal trend, which makes sense. We're going into summertime, right? Mm-hmm. So I'll just look at those seasonals and say, okay, is there a thesis to be had here? Crude oil's got a couple more inputs. Natural gas is almost purely supply and weather. But I don't know which companies are saying they're going to do something and which ones are actually doing things at this stage. So it's just, if I don't know something, for me, it's better off just not looking at it.
Right. Yeah. Crude oil does not have a board. So just by that.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I wanted to move on to something else. And as I've mentioned a few times, I love having the Chicago guys on, whether it's you or Urio or Bajurian or Kilberg, because you guys always keep your eye on the dollar. And the dollar is again, right around that 90 level where it's kind of it's on the way down, but around the 90 level that it's tested a number of times this year. Do you have an outlook for that? And how would that affect your view on crude oil as well?
So I recently was long the euro currency. And it's funny because you mentioned Urio, he was long the Canadian dollar, and his trade worked better than mine. And I believe me, it pains me to admit that anywhere publicly. But from the perspective of his thesis was commodity-based currency and my thesis was dollar weakness. And we both ended up being right, but he ended up being more right because commodities shot up at a much quicker pace than the dollar weakened. I think the dollar continues lower. And it's a really simple thesis. We've got two or three central banks, two majors, three emerging, basically saying that they're going to start to exit at least asset purchases. We even had an official from the Bank of England last week say that there might actually be an earlier rate hike sometime in late 2022 if things kept improving. Our Federal Reserve is nowhere near that. Our FOMC is nowhere near that. It seemed like in the last minutes, they at least began talking about which was Jerome.
Exactly. Exactly.
It seemed like that happened. And Rich Clarida was kind of shocked by the CPI numbers. He seemed to have no real explanation. And you could tell because he said, I need to go back and look at these. I'm a believer that inflation is not transitory. And it's pretty, there's a lot of ifs in my thesis for why inflation is not transitory, but the main one being the administration is from the Democrats running Congress to having the White House. They're all about a new minimum wage law, and they may not get the actual law passed, but if they continue to issue stimulus, it seems to me that it's sort of a faux minimum wage hike, because we've already seen Amazon, McDonald's, Walmart, Bank of America all raise their minimum wages because they can't get people to come to work because the federal benefits are so high. So you already have a form of UBI when you have this augmented unemployment benefits. I know anecdotally of some people who are not going back to work because they'd rather sit at home and earn slightly less. The bonuses in Chicago were upwards of $2,000. I've made a permanent move down to South Florida. Those bonuses are right around $1,000 to $1,500 for workers to come back. That's a labor cost input, and that's what's been missing from inflation. Yet our Fed still believes, my job is not to say whether the Fed is right or wrong, by the way. My job is to basically decide what it's going to look like in terms of P&L. And I don't see the dollar rallying while the Fed is going to continue to try and manage rates in the face of inflation, what I think is inflation. So I think the dollar continues to go lower. I think the lows that we saw in the dollar index in January will get broken. I believe they were somewhere around 89 and change. So I have a target somewhere around 87 for the dollar index. And I actually play that by buying the euro, because I think the euro is a little bit behind in pandemic recovery. And there's a spike in the euro that's coming, which would be the catch up that I'm looking for.
Interesting. So just, you know, on the inflation numbers, you mentioned the CPI. You also left, we got the core PCE above 3% for the first time since the early 90s. And then Tuesday morning, a few hours ago, as we're talking here, the May ISM manufacturing, just off the 17-year high, recently hit. Also, longest delivery time since 1974, indicating, according to an economist I follow, manufacturers continue to struggle with supply shortages, shipping delays, and difficulty finding skilled labor. Ultimately, that's going to wind its way into either wage inflation or higher prices for consumers, or both, right? There's sort of no way around that.
Absolutely.
And to your point, the Fed, they're just talking about maybe doing something, and they're going to taper before they tighten. So they're a long way from doing anything. And as you just said, it's hard to see how the dollar could not fall in that kind of environment. I did want to just go back to commodities for one second, because China, it was just last week, I believe, we were talking about, you know, their statements about trying to suppress speculation in commodities. Is what's happening in crude as we're talking here now? Copper was up a bunch earlier today too. Is that a suggestion that, you know, they don't have as much control over commodity prices as they would like, and their attempts to control and command commodities globally is not going to work?
I think when you're talking about a regime that is so used to being able to control everything, I think the rhetoric makes sense. I don't think they have any more control over commodity price speculation from the rest of the world, which is where a lot of it comes from, than the Fed does for controlling the yield on a 30-year. They have some control, but they're not going to be able to do it once it gets past a certain point. So I think that the response by the People's Bank of China finance minister, who said that they weren't going to use the yuan fixing to control commodity prices, that's when we got the snapback. And we got that late last week. So I think that was kind of the way that people thought they would kind of let the yuan move a little bit more and try and control the commodity prices through that. And they confirmed that they weren't going to, that the policy in its current state was good for the people of China, was, I believe, the, I'm not quoting directly, but I'm, you know.
That was the gist, kind of, yeah.
Yeah, that was the paraphrasing of it. I think that's when commodities snapped back, because we saw copper recover most of the losses, crude recover some of the losses after those comments. So yes, and I think your whole point about it trickling down to the consumer at some point, as you mentioned with the PCE, we're already seeing that. And I still think the Fed thinks that's transitory. But if it starts to build, the one thing that can go down is input prices. The one thing that won't go down is labor prices. You either get layoffs or the bottom wage stays where it is. It takes a long time to get a minimum wage up, whether it's voluntary or legislative, as we know from the legislative side. It doesn't go back down. The labor input starts to rise across the board. small businesses will get hurt because they can't afford to pay it, and large businesses will pay it and will continue to pay it. They won't drop that wage. So that input to me is permanent. So that's the part of it that I struggle with in terms of inflation being transitory. Commodity prices can fall back down, sure. But if you're paying your employees $25 an hour, which is what Bank of America raised their wage to, it's not going down from there.
We're going to take a step back, take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Alpha Trader. Our guest is Bob Iacino, co-portfolio manager of the Stock Think Tank. We'll be right back. All right, welcome back to Alpha Trader. We're speaking with Bob Iacino, co-portfolio manager of the Stock Think Tank, host of the Market Think Tank. And Bob, we just had a robust conversation about commodities and the dollar. Haven't really talked much about stocks. Would love to hear your thoughts first broadly on the overall market. As I mentioned, the S&P, it's not far from its all-time high. The NASDAQ has shown some relative weakness in the last month or so. It's not longer. What is your big picture take on the characteristic of the U.S. stock market here?
Well, I still think you have to be looking at the reflation / reopening trade. And I still think you have to look at value. The Stock Think Tank's model portfolio is really more of a value portfolio, but we sort of have our own definition of value that's proprietary. I don't know that we fall within traditional, but we end up sort of running along the same railroad tracks as value investors do from the purpose of the model portfolio. That's not necessarily a personal stance. But it is a firm stance. And when we look at some of the things that we hold, we don't really hold anything. We don't really hold any of the high flyers. We've never had Tesla. We've owned Apple a couple of times. We tried buying it again recently. We didn't get it in our price, so it came off our board. We own Intel. But the rest of it, we own Regeneron. We own Worthington Industries. We own CBOE. We own Nautilus. We own some of the things that match up with the reflation trade and some of the things that the price action is just a little confusing until we look deeper into it. I'll actually give you a good example. We recently owned a dentistry supply company that a lot of people probably never heard of. And it was one of our better active investments in quite some time. And it came to us through one of our price action scans. Okay. It's a company called Henry Sheen, which the symbol is HSIC. We took a full profit on that in really a very short period of time by our standards. And it was, we started thinking about it and we said, well, that makes sense. What was the one thing you couldn't DoorDash or Uber Eats or Amazon? And that's dental care. You know, you actually have to still go see your dentist. So for 18 months, people weren't able to go see their dentist and now they're going and the dentists need to restock supplies. So it made sense that that stock was moving at a higher rate. We don't necessarily look for stocks that way, but when our portfolio starts to fill up, it's interesting to see what the thesis is behind the portfolio as a whole. And it seems to be starting to be a mix of things rather than just reflation. But the market is still overall going to be driven by tech in the long run. It's just what it's going to be. It's almost become the food that the market eats.
We can't let any guests come through without asking about cryptocurrencies and specifically Bitcoin. It's obviously had a very rough run. It was down 35% in May, one of the worst months in the history of Bitcoin. Where do you have an outlook for that? Do you see a quick bounce or is it on its way to zero?
Well, I don't think either, to be honest. I think it's going to go through another one of those sideways cycles. There's a lot of controversy about the underlying structure of the cryptocurrency market and whether the stable coins that account for some 60-70% of the trade in Bitcoin are actually stable or incredibly unstable. And that's about as far as I want to go. But a lot of the articles are on Seeking Alpha. You can see some of them there and you can see them in other places. And I think that's probably going to prevent explosive institutional growth in cryptos until that sorts itself out. I don't think the institutions are afraid of the price action right now because they're very good at allocating percentages of their portfolio and being very disciplined with that. But as we see Bitcoin fall into the mid to low 30s and struggle to get out, and then Ether, which was taking up a lot of the slack and has kind of slowed as well, I mean, those are the lead horses for cryptocurrencies. And generally, I remember talking to a client recently and he said, wow, cryptos make stocks look boring because anything you buy a week later, you're up. Mm-hmm. And I actually took a screenshot and sent it back to him and said, this is the text I'm going to send back to you. right?
Right.
And I had another client say to me, cryptos are falling, what's wrong? And my answer was, when cryptos are going straight up, you should be asking me what's wrong, because that's not what markets do. So there's always a reckoning. I don't know if this is the reckoning or not. Full disclosure, I have owned Bitcoin in the past. I own it now, but my original investment has been fully cashed out. So I don't lose any sleep over cryptos that I own, because I've taken my original investment plus a little something out. And if they go to zero, I will still have made money on cryptocurrencies, and I could talk about it for 20 years. I don't believe they're going to zero, but I believe that they are going in a sideways pattern. This is another one of those sort of cleaning out phases where some of the assets that shouldn't be traded are probably not going to be traded.
When you said that the stable coins, I just so we're clear, I think you're talking about the practice of issuing these so-called stable coins, which are meant, as the term says, to stay at a fairly constant value, supposedly backed by dollars, massive issuance of right. these things. And then those coins are then turned around and used to buy Bitcoin. And so there's a decent amount of FUD out there, fear, uncertainty, doubt, around the fact that you know, maybe these things aren't actually backed by dollars. Maybe they're just backed by nothing more than thin air, and yet being used to buy massive amounts of Bitcoin.
Yeah, I don't know if, again, I don't know enough about it to opine intelligently or ethically, I should say. That's a better way of saying it. But as I start to look at the amount of stable coins that are out there, I think to myself, why do I have any dollars in my pocket? Because it seems like they have all of them.
Right.
And so that always just kind of raises an eyebrow for me. And I'm like, you know, maybe I better pare some of this back and just kind of be happy that I already made 100% on my earlier investments and just kind of let the rest sit there and let everybody else work it out. And if they take my last investment, that's fine. I end up with 100% or so gain on what I bought early, and it's okay with me. So I think people need to take a much closer look at it. And I think that they don't. And whenever that happens, it usually ends badly.
So, Bob, I'm curious. I've asked our last couple of weeks this question, which is whether you think what's happening in Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies more generally is in any way a reflection of risk appetites more generally, and does that have implication for stocks?
I think it's more of, yeah, risk appetites is what everybody calls it, but it's greed appetite is what it is. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's very similar to what has happened in the housing market before, and I would argue is probably happening now. It's what happened in the bubble in the 2000s with tech stocks, with pets.com and the likes of those. I feel the same way that I did then when I saw people going, hey, I bought Red Hat at 7 and it's at 14, so I sold it. And when it goes down to 9, I'm going to buy it again and then I'll sell it at 18. And I'm like, what are you guys doing? This isn't real life. And it turned out not to be real life. Although some of them survived, I suspect the cryptocurrency world is going through the same thing. There'll be a big washout. A lot of people will get hurt. And then there'll be a handful that survive and become going concerns.
Got it. And in the couple minutes we have left, we appreciate your time here this morning. You sort of referenced it, I don't know intentionally or not, the meme stocks have been on fire again. AMC was up Tuesday morning after raising $230 million in a secondary offering. It had doubled last week. And some of the other meme stocks like Virgin Galactic and GameStop also were up a lot last week. I'm assuming from what you said earlier about being more of a value investor, that's not an area you guys dabble in. But what is that telling you, if anything, about greed appetites?
You know, our stock think tank model portfolio was up over 62% last year doing value, because for us, it's about the process. I'd rather do that then go into things like the meme stocks. And I'd rather transition in companies like, take active investments in companies like Walmart, Lululemon, and Nike, and the things that I know that make money. GameStop and AMC, their core businesses are both nostalgia businesses. You could say that theaters are still around and people still like to go to them. I would agree. The last theater I went to pre-pandemic was not full. So they're both going to be nostalgia businesses. And unless both of them can launch streaming services for games and for movies that can compete with what's already out there, they're likely at some point going to zero. That doesn't mean that people won't make money in the short term. It just means that I won't.
Got it. And before we go, you know, you mentioned some of the names in your portfolio here. Anything particular you're bullish on currently, you're recommending to subscribers? Any names that you would be buying more of here?
I will tell you, we're looking at both Bank of America and Applied Materials. We're looking at both of those right now. If we can get a little pullback on both of those, we'll buy both. Worthington is manufacturing, Applied Materials is that as well. And Bank of America's financials, which we haven't been in quite some time, except for CBOE Global Markets. I still like silver. We got in silver in February, and we're still holding in that position. I think that's going to be probably our biggest winner of 2021. We're up a very small amount on it right now. We've been underwater most of the time that we've owned it. So I like those three quite a bit.
All right. Our guest has been Bob Iacino, co-portfolio manager of the stock think tank. Bob, thanks as always for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.